Morning, Council. Before we started, I wanted to address an issue relating to the verdict, in this case, being under seal. Now, I understand the trial court sealed the verdict because it viewed the verdict as tainted, and I think because he wanted to make clear that his decision on the mistrial motion was not affected by his knowledge of the verdict. But given that, since the case is now on appeal, I wanted to ask both counsel if they see any reason why the verdict should remain sealed for purposes of appeal. Obviously, we're not deciding whether we can consider that in reviewing the mistrial order, but just for purposes of appeal, whether there's any thoughts on or any reason as to why we shouldn't unseal it. I guess that's my question. Mr. Shigetomi? Mr. Fudo?
I pretty much concur with what opposing counsel said. And it's been my experience that they seal it for the purposes of the appeal, that being the case, and not for appeal, and also because everybody knows that what the verdict was, and there was a motion post, you know, while the case is on appeal, remanded back to the Circuit Court. It is what it is.
All right. So for purposes, what I'm going to do then is I'm going to unseal the currently sealed portion of the record that contains the verdict that the court filed. So for purposes of appeal, that record is unsealed.
Sorry, Mark. One other thought, just maybe logistically, it's been my experience, when documents are sealed, the litigants would not be able to open them through desks. This was definitely open. Just click on the icon. So I don't know if it was a logistical problem or something, but it's a little bit different than what I usually understand, sealed and confidential to me.
Right. All right. All right. Yes, sir. Shigetomi, please proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. Chief Judge, Associate Judges, I'm Keith Shigetomi. I'm arguing for Roy Scovea, the appellant in this case. Well, in this case, the trials had. Jury was instructed, deliberated, and at 14:20 hours, they sent a communication saying we reached the verdict. 4 minutes later, another communication was sent expressing a concern about someone on the prosecutor's side of the courtroom glaring and whistling, and they said that they had a concern for their safety. Because of that, the court and counsel had a chance to individually question the jurors. Not a single juror said the incident or the discussion regarding the incident affected their verdict. Two of the jurors associated the behavior with the prosecutor's side. No one associated with Roy Scovea. At the conclusion of the individual questioning, the trial court addressed the defense and said, do you have a motion for mistrial? In essence, say, make your motion or forever hold your peace. And at that point, we did not make the motion. At that point, the state requested the mistrial. And the court's exact quote was, if you're going to move for mistrial, you better ask me to find manifest necessity because jeopardy is attached. And in basketball, they probably call that dropping a dime, but with that assist, prosecutor then asked to the court to find manifest necessity and declare the mistrial, which the court did. We obviously objected. We filed a motion to dismiss for double jeopardy, saying that manifest necessity was not necessary, was not the correct decision under the circumstances. That motion was denied, and here we are. Appealing the denial of the motion.
Can you articulate specifically what aspect of this process you're saying the court erred in? In other words, first of all, the voir dire of the jurors, both sides agreed that that was appropriate.
Correct.
So I take it you're not contesting the fact that he actually individually voir dired the juror.
No.
So what part of this process are you arguing on appeal that the trial court erred in doing?
The trial court ignored the jurors' responses that every single juror said it did not affect them. Every single one. Not a single one said it affected me. For the court to then say, well, I don't believe you. I mean, in essence, is what the court said, was clearly wrong.
Isn't that the court's prerogative, though, as a fact finder? I mean, is that sort of black-letter law, finder of fact, makes the credibility calls? That's something that the appellate court has to give deference to? How do you get over that black-letter principle of law?
Because our position is, one, the record lacks substantial evidence to support the finding, and two, even if there was substantial evidence to support the finding, this court is left with the definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. I mean, that's a standard for clearly erroneous. And the court basically made its decision saying, I don't believe you, when there's nothing to the contrary. I mean, you can have this belief, but again, the finding of manifest necessity has to be made beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this situation, the court's finding, our position, was clearly erroneous, and therefore the declaration of the mistrial was wrong.
So there was, there was one juror who said, I wasn't affected by the situation, but I think other jurors were, right? Something to that effect, right?
Okay, one juror said it appeared to affect.
Okay.
Okay.
So a couple of other jurors.
Yes.
Okay.
And I would only analogize to State versus Nakulou, where under similar circumstances, there was concern the jurors expressed for their safety. The trial court individually voir dired everyone. And during that voir dire process, everyone in that case said the concern had not affected their ability to be fair and impartial. In that particular case, there were a number of jurors said, well, I think juror number four, I can't remember the exact number, but juror number X was affected, appeared to be affected, was, you know, concerned because that juror lived in the area of the defendant and the defendant's family. And when that juror was individually questioned, that juror said, no, I'm okay, I can be fair and impartial, I can make a decision solely on the evidence. And that, in essence, is what happened in this particular case. One person may have had the impression, or it appeared to that person, that there may have been some effect, but every single juror denied any effect.
But isn't that a case that just stands for the proposition that whichever way the court makes a credibility call on appeal, that the appellate court basically goes along with that exercise of judgment? In other words, that case doesn't necessarily mean that we have to, that whenever a juror says, oh, I wasn't influenced, the court must accept that testimony as being truthful. It just says in that case, the court found that testimony was true. In this case, the court went the other way. So why can't we, I'll give you a hypothetical. Okay, so say the situation is the defendant prior conviction for some heinous crime that the court had excluded at trial becomes known to the jury because they read a newspaper article. And the same thing happens. All the jurors go, oh, no, we saw the article. We know the guy has a prior conviction. Didn't influence our decision. Would we be bound by whatever, would the trial court be bound by whatever the fact that the jurors say, like, not influence? Would the trial court be compelled not to grant a mistrial in that situation? And if not, why is this case any different?
Okay. Well, I think the hypothetical that you raise, I think, is similar to State versus Bailey, in which a juror discloses during deliberations that she was aware that the defendant astounded by that. And just as an aside, we're retrying the case right now. The court denied the motion for mistrial. And eventually the Supreme Court said, no, that was an error. Now, in this case, I'd be the first to agree that you have the right to accept the trial court's findings, okay? But I would also argue that you also have a responsibility to make a finding that those findings that the trial court made were not clearly erroneous. And that is our position here, that yes, he made his decision that he didn't believe 12 jurors, okay? But that, our argument again is that because there was substantial, that even if there's, I don't think there's substantial evidence, but even if you said there was substantial evidence, you have to have the feeling that it was wrong, or some aspect of it was wrong. And that's our position as to the clearly erroneous. So yes, you give it deference, but you also have to weigh it under the clearly erroneous standard.
Mr. Shikitomi, yes. You know, in terms of analyzing the court's abuse of discretion or not, what role, if any, should the potential verdict or what people thought the verdict may have been at that point play into our analysis?
Well, I'm going to the
verdict. If at all.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to tell you it has great importance, but obviously Judge Kim didn't know about it at the time. We had our suspicions, obviously.
And he expressly articulated that obviously that he couldn't tell what it was. I mean, that's what the record says, at least.
Well, I think his words were, we're all adults here. We know we can sort of read the handwriting on the wall. But
should that matter to our analysis?
I mean, I cannot see how, I mean, I suppose obviously you can disagree with me, but I can't see how you can disregard it. I mean, when you get something that's sealed for the records of appeal, for the purposes of appeal, you're going to review it. I mean, that's your responsibility. You have to review it and give it the weight that I guess you believe is appropriate to that, and considering the claim that their jury was no longer able to reach a fair and impartial verdict. I mean, they all said that they could, and if they had, and it hadn't, it had not reached to that point where it affected them. They also said that the purpose of the communication was not to ask the court to do anything or take any action, simply say, hey, we just want to let you know.
Did the court have to make a determination of which way this external incident affected the jury before making the mistrial call? In other words, does he have to make a finding that I think it influenced the jury for or against one side or the other?
I mean, it certainly would be helpful, you know, whether he was required to or should have, you know, we all are operating under the moment of the circumstances, so. But I would say that it would have been helpful to the court, and the fact that the jurors said that they associated with the prosecutor's side, despite that, or, you know, the courts have said that the primary, the important consideration for the purposes of the double jeopardy clause is that the defendant retained primary control over the course to be followed in the event of such an error. And we were given the first opportunity, and we absolutely declined. We refused. We said, no, we believe in this jury. We want to keep this jury. And the state Supreme Court here has said that a defendant has a valued right to have his trial completed by a particular tribunal, and that the manifest necessity has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
But does the trial court have, regardless of what the parties want, does the trial court have an independent obligation to assure itself that the process was fair? In other words, regardless if both parties for some reason think they prevail in the case, but the judge feels that the verdict was rendered by a jury that was not impartial, does the court have an independent obligation to say or to make its own judgment call as to whether the process was tainted?
You know, I would say yes. I will also note that at the in this particular case, when we got the communications, the trial court had indicated that it was just going to go ahead and take the verdict. And it was only because both sides requested that the individual question be had was that we actually went through that process. So obviously at that point, I was saying you have an independent duty. So yeah, I would say yes, they do.
Now, do you have any, I know you're saying that the court should not have granted the mistrial, but do you have any argument that the court erred in not taking in deciding the mistrial before taking the verdict? In other words, should the court have taken the verdict without deciding the mistrial motion?
Well, I mean, the only thing I can say is clearly it would have been beneficial to me if he had done that.
Yeah, that's not a principle for us to like, decide the case on.
And I'm just saying, you know, I think that as parties would expect the trial court to make a decision at that point. I mean, that's all I can say. I mean, we would expect a decision. And the court made a decision. We clearly disagree with it, but it made a decision.
So if I can capsulize it, your basic position on appeal is that under the circumstances of this case, we should override the trial judge's credibility call because we have a firm and definite conviction that a mistake was made.
Yes.
And if we disagree with that, does that necessarily mean that we should affirm the court's decision? In other words, do you have any other argument besides that argument to support your position?
Obviously, that's pretty much the foundation of our argument. We would also argue that even if that were the case, that it wasn't proven that manifest necessity had been established beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, what's the basis for that decision? In other words, the court found that the jury had been influenced, or at least some jurors had been influenced by this incident. Why are you saying that finding is not sufficient to meet the manifest necessity requirement?
Well, to say that there was some, I don't believe that they're saying that. I mean, it doesn't say that he's not actually saying, I find that they were, I just don't believe it. I mean, that was his finding, I don't believe it. And so there's nothing definite to say, hey, beyond a reasonable doubt, it had no effect. And that's, again, what we're saying is that that's the burden. That's what the court must find, beyond a reasonable doubt. And when not a single person says there was effect, and my verdict was untainted, then at that point it was error, in particular because the case law supports, it's the defendant who has primary control, or should have primary control. And when he asked us, we said, no, we will stick with this particular jury. So for those reasons, we're asking the court to reverse the denial of a motion to dismiss for violation of double jeopardy, to order that be granted, and to dismiss the case with prejudice.
Thank you. Mr. Fudo.
Good morning. I'm Don Fudo for the prosecution. To me,
Mr. Fudo, can I maybe the mic down so that we pick up the recording better? Yeah.
To me, what the central issue in this case is and revolves around is the defendant's entitlement to a trial by an impartial jury. Standard dictionary definitions of impartial include unbiased, free from strong feelings, uninfluenced by strong feelings or emotions. To say that fear, if genuine, isn't a strong feeling that causes people to react irrationally, I just believe that ignores the obvious. If you're sitting in a Jewish delicatessen in France, an armed gunman storm in and shoot three people, and you as a 22-year-old black employee of that place have the presence of mind to not think about yourself, but guided by fear, lead the employees to a freezer to hide, and then remember there is an escape route, implore them to take it, they're afraid to go, you go, tell the police, that's fear.
Mr. Fudo,
yes.
The juror's expression of concern for their safety is not an unusual event. In many cases in which the defendant has committed a violent crime, I mean, isn't it, I wouldn't say a routine, but isn't it not an infrequent situation in which the jurors at some point in the trial may express some concern about their safety as sitting on the jury? But in every case in which a juror expresses concern for safety or mentions a safety issue, we don't automatically go, okay, mistrial, we got to start all over again, because I would think that would make it very difficult to get through any of these types of trials. So it can't be just an expression of concern that automatically voids the case. What's different about this particular case?
Okay, first to address some of the statements you made. I'm not prepared to say that it's common, as you are. I'm prepared to say that I found one published case on the issue, and that's, and I'll mispronounce it, Naku L-O-U, and that dealt with it. And the court recognized that fear is a concern. Moreover, the characterization that we just, like, almost automatically declare a mistrial, that's not what happened in this case. What happened in this
case... But in that case, the court let the case go on, right?
Well, I don't believe so. What the standard, what the case?
No, in the Napuolu case, I think it is.
Right.
The court found that the juror's expression of concern did not require mistrial.
Right. After going through a methodical process, which the court followed in this case, because that is the precedent, he didn't just automatically declare a mistrial. As counsel has already conceded, both parties, with the concern for the sanctity of the impartiality of the deliberations, wanted the jurors pulled. There was a communication that came back in, and it was a little bit more than just a concern for safety, as evinced by the responses of the jurors. When they're identifying things as retaliation, there's more women than men, they're afraid of the consequences of rendering a verdict, that goes directly to their responsibility as impartial jurors. And if fear pervades the deliberations, can we really say that that didn't play a role? Now, I've heard a representation that the individual was only on the prosecutor's side. The side shouldn't matter, but for point of clarification, there was also a juror who said that the individual was on defense's side. Now, we don't know...
You know which juror that was?
Yes, I do know which juror that was. That was juror three, here and whistling from a man on defendant's side of the gallery this morning, but could not tell exactly who. Defense counsel asked him which side. He thought the whistling came from the defendant's side. That's at the docket 24, page 17, lines 19 through 24. Again, docket 24, at page 76, lines 2 through 14. It shouldn't really matter, and we shouldn't really engage in speculation that had it been from one side versus the other, it would be more pervasive as to the fear element that clearly cast a pale over these deliberations. If you look at the time of deliberations in a reckless manslaughter case, they deliberated 2.5 hours. Now, for those of us who've done trials, even if it weren't a charge as significant as that. 2.5 hours, that's a rather quick verdict, especially when they had to have lunch in between that, and that's revealed by the court summary. But be that as it may, when you're asking, as I must, what standard is applied on appeal, I've been doing this for a while, and I kind of come to understand that when you don't challenge a finding of fact on appeal, it's binding. I'm old. I make mistakes. I have trifocals. But what I didn't think I saw in the opening brief or the reply brief were any challenges to any of the findings of fact. So now to say that for the first time on appeal, they're wrong, for me that's a little bit of a perverse way to do an argument. I incorporated that standard and those facts in my answer. Personal opinions about what the court did, I always set aside on appeal and looked to the standard. They weren't challenged. And when you look to findings 9, 10, and 11, for example, it related that the court found that the juries were worried about retaliation, the man appeared very hostile, the jurors were concerned, the jurors felt intimidated.
But the context of it, putting aside what the verdict actually was, given what the jurors said during the voir dire, isn't the clear implication that the hostility was from the prosecution side to the defendant? And so if they had a safety concern after they rendered their verdict, it would have been a safety concern about that would be a situation in which they were concerned because they had found the defendant not guilty?
No, I'm not going to agree with that.
You don't see it that way?
We only have four people saying ostensibly where the person was seated. And if I'm a juror, and this is the hypothetical me, not the actual me, I'm in a case where I know the person is accused of killing someone else. So to me, it's not like a Berg case or something like that where a defendant might be a little bit put off because he has to go to jail. This is a person that has killed. For me not to appreciate and respect those regular people's concern for their safety is just not something I'm going to do, and I'm not going to speculate as to the genuineness of their fear, in as much as the trial court who was there and saw the people testifying over a two-day, not believably type hearing.
Does the record indicate which way the court felt the influence cut in favor of one side or the other?
No, because he's not required to. What he did is required by the law was find that he couldn't find beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless. And that's what Napulo. Thank you. Says.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. No. Says we must do. And the Napulo case acknowledges as the first step, fear would be that kind of genuine concern which would cause and require a court to engage in this analysis.
So you're saying anytime the jurors express fear, there's a mistrial?
I'm not saying anything.
Oh, okay, so what's the defining factor of this case from those cases that indicate that a mistrial was warranted in this case?
That the court found that the fear was specific, unlike Napulo, which was abstract. People, jurors, had witnessed it. They said that they were affected by it. Just a moment. That they, unlike Napulo, they weren't merely peripheral. That the discussions about fear, unlike Napulo, came up repeatedly during the deliberations. From the moment they went in there, throughout it, to the very end, that always pervaded it. And if you look and compare these facts to Napulo, they're quite different. Moreover, unlike the judge in Napulo, this judge didn't find the jurors credible. As you pointed out, Napulo doesn't stand for anything beyond the facts of that case, and that a judge, his discretion, should be given great deference, as Quintog says, in these matters.
But the incident as described was someone sitting on the prosecution side basically directing hostile action toward the defendant. Mm-hmm. Right? So the incident didn't involve any kind of hostility by the defendant. So when they identify the incident as a cause of their safety concern, doesn't it stand to reason that they're not concerned, their concern for personal safety doesn't come from the defense side, it comes from the prosecution side. So the adverse inference would be toward the defendant, but the defendant doesn't want the mistrial. So does that factor into the decision as to whether the court properly granted the mistrial?
No, because what I hear you saying is they're afraid. And maybe
but they described why they were afraid. They didn't just say we were afraid. They said we were afraid because we saw a guy on the prosecution side making hostile actions toward the defendant.
Right.
All right, so that doesn't mean that that person's aligned with the defendant. It means it's aligned with the victim of the prosecution.
And the consequence of that is what, in your Honor's mind?
So the way that that would adversely influence a jury would be to find the defendant not guilty, right? In other words, if they're concerned for their safety, it's not the influence is influencing it in one direction.
No, I think by what you're saying and what you seem to be believing fear would, the conduct that fear would engender, if the person is aligned with the prosecutor, then I think I'm hearing you saying he's aligned with the victim. So what I'm thinking is...
No, but he's directing his hostility toward the defendant.
Right.
So if the jury found the defendant not guilty, why would they wouldn't be afraid of the defendant?
I think they would be afraid of the defendant. Because if I'm the victim's brother and I'm glaring at the defendant, what I'm also doing is telling you 12, if you guys walk that guy, you're going to deal with me. So I think it would have the opposite effect of what you're saying. And since at the time of the Napoolo hearing...
Right, but that would influence them to find him guilty, right? Not to find him not guilty.
Right, and improperly find him guilty. See, that is the point. Your hypothetical recognizes that the genuine fear would affect the verdict with regard to matters that were extraneous to the evidence. I have a guy threatening me.
So you're saying that was the court's concern, that notwithstanding the fact that the defense wanted to take the verdict, the court believed that the defendant's judgment was erroneous, and it was concerned that the jury had been influenced to find the defendant guilty.
No. The court didn't engage in that speculation. That's why he repeatedly said, I don't know the verdict. It wasn't going to play a factor. The court was properly and genuinely concerned only with what precedent says he must be, and that is whether the jury, in their deliberations, could be fair and impartial and only consider the evidence presented at trial. Everybody agreed that the bald-head, angry man is extraneous to the evidence of trial. Everyone agrees, and there's been no dispute, that this issue with this individual came up repeatedly and was a significant part in the discussion, and what the court believed is that it is counterintuitive to think, as many times it was raised, as revealed by as many jurors, to then say, oh, they're all heroes. They just put that fear aside and just did their duty. That's not erroneous. That's reality. We're all heroes when we're not looking down the barrel of a gun. We're all sometimes what seems to be less than heroic when we are, and that's a function of fear. And that's why fear should not play a role in a jury's deliberations. And at the point it's revealed, Napoolo says the court is duty-bound then to investigate, did this fear rise to the level of being specific, or in the case of Napoolo, it was abstract.
So you don't think it matters which way the safety concern cut? In other words, whether it would cut in a direction of finding the defendant guilty or not guilty? That shouldn't be a factor that we consider in determining whether the trial court abuses discretion or not.
Your Honor, respectfully, I'm not saying I don't think it shouldn't be a factor. Again, I guess I've just done this too long. I'm just saying that the case law doesn't say that's the factor. The case law identifies fear. If fear cuts one way or the other, I really can't wrap my mind around, then how is that a legitimate subject of deliberations? I'm looking back there and I see people and I'm afraid, so I'm not going to say something in an oral argument. I don't understand that. If you're having a sporting contest and one person has been told, the star athlete has been told before the contest, you win, your mother dies. Can we really say that that was a fair contest? Regardless of which way it cut, regardless of whether...
Okay, so your answer is it doesn't matter which way it cuts.
No, I'm saying that what it does is taints that game.
No. In terms of us evaluating the court's decision, you're saying the critical factor is whether there was extraneous influence, whether it cut in favor or against the defendant is irrelevant to the court's decision on the mistrial.
Not irrelevant. What Napoolo in the case law says, when there's an extraneous influence, you have to first determine whether it would affect detrimentally the defendant's right to an impartial jury. So that's the, as you are saying, and I'll paraphrase, how we determine the cut? Not how it favored, but just did it impact the impartiality of the jury in their deliberations?
Mr. Fudo, as you just prefaced your last statement, it's looking at the defendant's right to an impartial jury, right? And that's the exact language in Malpuloa, that they set out the purpose for the standard that we follow, right? You first look at whether there's a incident that may have substantially prejudiced the defendant's right to that fair trial. If that's the case, you go through the process of investigating the totality of the circumstances, which is what the circuit court did here, which is what both parties agreed should be done, correct? So it's really just that last part of the test there in terms of, and you folks have properly, I think, articulated it, which is given what the circuit court heard from the jurors, was there enough for him to find that the rebuttable presumption of prejudice was proven harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? That's really where we are in this case, right? Would you agree with that?
I would agree with most of what you said. Can I tweak
what part don't you agree?
Not disagree. Would just add. But in the consideration with respect to the declaration of mistrial, it's not only the defendant's right that we concern ourselves with. Quitog makes quite clear. Also, the public has an interest in affording the prosecutor one full and fair opportunity to present his evidence to, again, and this coalesces with the defendant's right, an impartial jury.
Well, that's where I was going, because, and maybe you've already answered my question, but Mr. Shigatomi argues that really at that point where we are in this case, because it's prefaced, this whole analysis is prefaced, especially in Napolo and many of the other cases, on the defendant's right to a fair trial, to what extent should the defendant's request whether to have a mistrial or not should matter?
Significantly.
And how should that matter in terms of the court and whether the circuit court and whether it abused its discretion or not in this case?
Well, as I pointed out in my brief, because the defendant's very significant right to a jury of the 12 he helped chose is highly respected, and I respect that. But in as much as I respect that, I also respect the trial court's responsibility to make a determination with respect to the credibility of the jurors. I wasn't there. Mr. Shigatomi was there. So if he had, and I mean this to no disrespect to Keith, if he honestly believed that the trial court erred in its findings of fact, maybe it should have been pointed out in the brief in the statement of points of error that I disagree with the court's finding here, 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 and here. During the hearings, Mr. Shigatomi conceded when questioned by the defense, by Judge Kim, that he respects his role as the fact finder. And if the court found as it ultimately did, Mr. Shigatomi agreed that mistrial would be warranted. Yes, he didn't want the mistrial, but he didn't dispute the fundamental components that go into and went into the judge's ultimate declaration thereof during the two-day hearing or on appeal. When I say appeal, the submissions he filed in the appeal.
The fact that in his points of error, he does not specifically challenge the findings of facts. That's what you're arguing, right?
That's what I'm pointing out. Right. I, at this stage, and I don't mean to parse words, but I'm not arguing it. It's just a fact. And I think it's a very critical fact because in appellate jurisprudence, there is a consequence to not challenging a finding of fact. It's otherwise binding on appeal. I understand if the appellate court, and I respect your opinions, are left with an abiding conviction within yourself that it's nevertheless incorrect, disregard it. The Supreme Court does it all the time, and we all know that. And we all sit back and we quietly think, they weren't even there. Now, not only are they saying the trial court was wrong, but now the ICA was wrong for respecting the deference that's supposed to be accorded to the trial judge's finding of fact and credibility assessments. How can I not, as the appellate counsel, how can I not, as a representative of the people of the state of Hawaii, who have this vested right to see that people are held accountable for their crimes, disregard those findings?
Mr. Fudo, let me ask you this. Most of these mistrial cases occur before a verdict is rendered. So this one is fairly unusual in the sense that the mistrial issue arises before the jury actually returned a verdict. But does that make the standard or the test different? In other words, in this case, there's a verdict, so I would assume that from the finality, the defendant's right to a final verdict of the 12 jurors that he picked or they both picked, that would be at paramount when the verdict is entered. So is there something different about this case because there's actually a verdict as opposed to the typical situation in which the mistrial motion arises before the verdict's rendered?
Maybe two thoughts on that matter. I agree that it's not typical for it to occur in this case. However, it is very common for the verdict to be rendered and then a time thereafter, and usually before sentencing, when defense counsel has gotten wind of jury impropriety, and then there's a motion to set aside the verdict. So I don't see that that's really critical. Furthermore, under Rule 31 of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure, it doesn't require the court to immediately read the verdict, and the verdict isn't accepted until the court accepts it. And traditionally, it's been my experience, when the charge is this significant, there will always be the poll. Now, if during the poll, one juror says, no, that's not my verdict, go back and deliberate. So there's nothing, I think, magical about the timing of the verdict. So I'm not sure I answered your question, but to me, it's neither here nor there whether he has the two communications. Okay, let's read the verdict first. The verdict is not guilty. I said it. And then, okay, now let's read the next communication, communication number two, which is the subject of this appeal. I think at that point, still, the prosecutor had the right and the responsibility in light of that communication, Your Honor, we need to investigate it. So the verdict was never officially taken, and it wouldn't be until the court, upon request of the defendant, polls him, they agree, or he decides not to poll, and then the court takes the verdict. Then they're discharged.
But if the court believed that the prejudice from this incident was adverse to the defendant, he could have taken the verdict, and if the verdict came back guilty, he could have given the defendant a new trial.
Yeah, he could have done that.
So why wouldn't that be in this case the proper procedure?
I'm not saying it wouldn't have been an option, but I don't see any rule of precedent that's been cited to me that says that was the only procedure. And I know how.
I mean, it's a judgment call. The court can make the judgment call either way.
Judgment call. It's a call that was made. And until someone tells me why it was wrong, and me being sentient, I will just defer to the judgment of the court. And nobody below was saying that it was improper. So I'm not prepared to argue that it was anything other than what was done. And I know how awkward this case is, and I really, honestly, truly respect you get the one trial prosecutor, and if it's an acquittal, that's what the people want. They want to acquit that individual. But when there's this kind of taint, and this case is so distinguishable from Nakuru, I believe that the prosecutor acted in the highest and best faith to protect the interests of the public from someone who during trial said, yes, I was the one that took that individual's life. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Very briefly, the evidence was that one juror heard whistling but forgot about it. One juror saw glaring. One juror saw glaring and heard whistling. One juror saw a person making angry faces and heard whistling. It was all directed towards the defendant. But Mr. Kudo points out that once someone said that it came from the defense side, simply that the person was sitting on that side and whistling at the defendant. That's the evidence that the court based upon saying the juror no longer can be fair and impartial. Jurors could no longer be fair and partial, despite the unanimous affirmation that they were, and that it had no effect on the jury. This is a verdict that was reached, unfortunately not returned or received by the court. So that's our position.
But everyone agrees the court didn't know what the verdict was, correct?
Not for certain, no.
All right, so assuming, I take it because you didn't ask for a mistrial, you at least believe that the juror, the verdict was not guilty. Now, can the court, even though you may have felt that, did the court have an independent ability to exercise its judgment and say, well, I'm not sure that this incident didn't adversely affect the defendant, so because I feel the process was tainted, I'm going to declare a mistrial?
I'll say this. The court gave us the ball and said, make your decision. You ask for the mistrial now, because if I take this verdict and you don't like it, you can't make the ball. He didn't say you can't make the motion, but basically the motion is going to be fruitless because you have your grounds now. I'm not going to let you pick and choose. I'm not going to let you ask the court to say roll the dice, choose. And we said we want this jury's verdict. And more as an afterthought, but when the prosecution made its request for the mistrial, then the court kind of said, well, okay, well, I'll consider it now. But at that point, it was giving Roscovea the decision to make whether or not the verdict should be returned. So, yes, we disagree with it. Yes, we obviously believe that the verdict, now that we all know about it, and you know, jurors told me what it was afterwards anyway, it should have an effect because we're dealing with double jeopardy and the verdict was not guilty. I don't have anything else unless the court has questions.
All right, any questions? All right, we'll take the matter in advisement. Thank you very much.